So the theme, when I received the invitation, was to talk about NoSQL, and I started out by writing some slides where I thought, let me give my vision, and then I realized it would be much more interesting for me to just talk about what I do and the problems I have and let other people figure out how to make life easier for me. The general themes for me are, the NoSQL systems have arrived, even at Facebook. They've talked a lot about using HBase. And some of that will eventually make my life easier. But the other theme is that production is hard. And I think it's underappreciated in the academic community. And it takes a long time to get systems into production that you can depend on. So what I do is I work on sharded MySQL deployments. In some ways, I'm an advocate, but I'm also trying to raise the bar for whatever will eventually replace what I do. We want to make things better, and it's really just an area where when you experience it firsthand, you realize there's a lot of little things, a lot of details that you need to get right. So from my perspective, the problem isn't the SQL, it's the implementations, which do great at solving problems they were designed to solve, and now we're pushing them in a new direction. For the areas I work in, we really need multi-master support. If you're running an application with users around the world, you need the databases close to the users, and it's frequently not easy to partition the data geographically. And the final thing is that the clever algorithms are easy. We have a lot of them. The hard part is using them. So this is numbers. These are numbers from last year from one of the database clusters. So we have multiple clusters. The interesting one to me is 13 million queries per second at peak. I don't list the number of machines. I tend to quote that as X thousand. 5 million page operations per second. Our databases are I/O bound. We cannot afford to cache all of our data. We do have, for a variety of different reasons, to get data closer to our web middleware. We do actually have a lot of caching above the database layer. But at the database, we cannot cache everything. Projects that my team is working on right now, we've been improving the hot backup utility for InnoDB, adding support to make it more efficient for incremental hot backup. We are trying to deploy page level compression from InnoDB. Eventually, we will have MySQL to HBase replication. A big project for us is getting parallel replication apply. So the code that applies changes on a slave when you're running master-slave replication, and for most database products, is single-threaded. And when your slave is I/O bound, that is unable to keep up with a very busy master. And we've implemented and published a tool for online schema change, and we continue to improve that. So my solution is, or what I think we want, is some SQL. We still need secondary indexes per node. So these are local secondary indexes, not global. We still need multiple operations in a transaction. We'll still need non-indexed predicates and data types, and we really need to push as much computation as possible to the data node, otherwise the network gets saturated. Our nodes need to support the hardware capacity that they have, so especially with the arrival of Flash, we need to be able to do 10,000 plus IOPS from whatever database engine we are running, and if we're doing 10,000 IOPS, we want to do 10,000 QPS. High concurrency, high contention access is a big problem for us. Things like Justin Bieber or Lady Gaga get a lot of activity, and whatever rows they use in our databases are very, very hot. So the database servers need to scale under this. And this was an interesting one for HBase. We have a very good and a very large and strong HBase development team. And when we began reproducing some of our MySQL workload on top of HBase, there are a lot of things that they are fixing, but a lot of problems that traditional database engines have solved. And the final thing is monitoring, debugging, and tuning. I'm not sure if, a general question is, has anyone ever attached GDB or fixed a problem in production using GDB? And I have. It's a very valuable tool. We have a server that occasionally has configuration variables that are not dynamic, unless you have GDB. So there are some, just one example of where the server just doesn't do as much as we want. At times we cringe when we say, oh, there's a configuration variable to fix that problem, but it's static and you have to restart the server and warm up the buffer pool, and the workaround is GDB. This general question for NoSQL, how do you coordinate schema changes? If all the applications embed the access path, they know which indexes they want to use, what happens when you need to change the schema? Do you have to coordinate a rolling upgrade across database tier, middleware, and the applications at the same time? What happens when the source control and the build system for that application was really the one you used 2 years ago, and you're not really building any of those applications anymore? I think the schema change issue is going to be a big problem for some of the NoSQL solutions getting into production. Write optimized storage, the biggest thing for me is the redundancy might be much cheaper. The point here is that how are you maintaining a replica? If you're shipping page images, then on the remote site, you only have to apply the writes. And in many cases, those are random writes. If you're using something like HBase, you're applying the writes. You're not shipping page images, and the deltas just become a sequential stream of writes. If you use a traditional database update in place, then it's a read modify write cycle. So you're doing a random read, making a page dirty, which eventually becomes a random write. And so there's a huge difference in the cost in IOPS needed to maintain a replica between these various schemes. And to me, this is the biggest deal, more so than being able to sustain high write throughput. This, I think, will be the biggest selling factor for getting some of the NoSQL solutions into production. But there are some interesting problems. If you are doing something like an LSM tree, you have the potential to increase the random writes because you have data that might be in multiple files. Bloom filters, and there is a paper, I think, on Bloom filters here. The HBase development teams are continuing to focus on this. If you're doing backup and compaction, can you share the same file scans? For me, a big problem is IOPS. I just need to reduce IOPS as much as possible because the reason we buy servers is to get more IOPS. Multi-master on a wide area network, this is something I don't have much experience with, but from my observation, the applications I support tend to be chatty. So from that perspective, eventual consistency, so that the application can quickly perform write transactions with a local database server, eventual consistency is a great idea, but we need transactions that are more complex than single row updates. Potentially now we have to think about conflict detection and resolution. And then strong consistency, and Alex is here, who worked on Megastore. The applications I tend to support have frequently been too chatty to tolerate that latency. So at that point, we have a redesign issue if we're going to use that. Final point, the world has a surplus of clever ideas. The hard part is getting this stuff into production. So, and if I knew the answer of how to get things into production, I would probably have my own company. But it's really where I think we should put much more focus. An example of how we do performance debugging in production, we use GDB or PStack, pipe that to awk, flatten the call stacks, and then look for the most frequent stacks to see where things are waiting on a mutex or IO, and then to look for the threads that are holding the mutexes. Prior to dtrace and systemtap, none of the performance tuning tools that we have are usable for me. I don't need to know where CPU is being spent, because the problem in production is, for me, has never been too much CPU. It's always been something is waiting on something else. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Oh, sorry, you can all hear me. Steve Jobs not here, is he? Oh, no, it's coming. It's restarting now.
Oh, lucky you.
Sorry.
Okay, you have to entertain them all.
So, yeah, again, like Mark said, when we were asked to do this, the theme was something along the lines of, I think it's in the program, NoSQL, big data, no problems, no worries, something like that. So, again, I started thinking, okay, well, NoSQL, should we have a big flame war? Should we try and antagonize all the MySQL fans and get the NoSQL people to come and jump on them and see what happens. So yeah, in the end, I decided I was going to talk a bit about what I thought big data meant, because people I personally keep reading this term over and over again, and I'm sure everyone else does. And more worryingly, a lot of people outside of this community keep reading it, and there's many different views about what this is and what it isn't. And I wanted to talk about how that relates to some of the work that's been done, and you know what my views are, and what's going to happen in the future. Why does this Mac take so long to boot up? I thought that was the selling feature of it. Ah, brilliant. Well, that's rubbish. I can't see that, so I'm going to. Oh God! Can I have your power?
We really did have this all planned.
This was perfect a minute ago, yeah.
This is an example of production.
Right. It should come, it's just loading all the crap. If Steve Jobs made data centers, right, imagine what they'd be like. They'd have curved edges. Yeah, they'd look beautiful, but yeah. Yeah, maybe if I had an SSD in here, it would be a lot better. In my defense, it's now loading Keynote, and sorry about this. Let's do ski rental. If I don't complete in 10 seconds, take over. More than 10 seconds. Yeah. All right. Go.
Hey,
I am on the display now, I bet. Now I see. But I can't see a thing, so. For God's sake. Somebody tell me where play is. This is insane. Why is.
Freezing.
Is that play? Thank you.
Okay, and our next speaker.
Right, okay, let's go. So yeah, I'm at a startup in London and also in Palo Alto now called The Kunu, which is sort of semi in stealth. We're launching in about 2 weeks in San Francisco. But I'm also an academic at Oxford in computer science and, well, combinatorics mostly. But okay, so. What do I want to talk about? So yeah, as I said, big data is, well, maybe this is a bit controversial, I don't know, but big data, this is my statement, that big data is not scale out, it's not web scale, it's not NoSQL, it's not synonymous with those things. It may be some of them, but it's not synonymous. So like Mark said, you know, some of the biggest people dealing with big data problems are using MySQL, right? You know, NoSQL is not going to solve you know, all the world's problems. And at the same time, some of the best-known NoSQL databases don't even scale out properly, if you look at something like CouchDB. So, you know, well, what is this big data thing then? So my proposition is this. It's about surfing. So what do I mean? So I was speaking to a friend a few weeks ago who is a bit crazy, but he really likes going and doing this kind of thing. Trying to kill himself and making his life insurance policy really high. So he was telling me, you know, to ride one of these huge waves, you've got to finally balance many, many huge, sort of huge unstoppable forces, right? And you know, the wave is going to carry on doing what it does, whether you're there or not. But if you want to ride it, you've got to know what it's going to do and how it's going to behave. And I think that dealing with big data problems. Is a bit like trying to ride this wave of technology that's happening. It's very easy to get to this situation. So if you try to work against it, it can really hurt you. So I guess in another way of putting it is that we need to understand what's happening in technology and try to harness these changes. And that's what I believe being able to handle big data is all about. So I have a few examples of what I mean. So this is a storage workshop. So let's look at storage technology, right? So on the left, you've got an SSD from, well, some unnamed manufacturer, ideally. You know, it's a, whatever, $60, $80, $100. Let's say 60 gigs. It can give us somewhere of the order of, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 random reads, perhaps random writes a second. And it can do sequential access around 100, 150 megs, 200 megs a second. So what can we get for $100 in a hard disk world? Well, we can get something sort of 2 or 3 terabytes, right? Spinning at, you know, 5,400, 7,000 RPM. And it's going to get about 100 IOPS a second. And it can do sequential reads and writes around 130, 140 megs a second. So. You know, the two major differences, right, like we all know, are capacity and random IOPS. But my point is that, you know, we really don't have algorithms at the moment to exploit these devices properly. We have algorithms that rely on random I.O. for the hard disk. We don't really have any algorithms that are tuned for SSDs. We just put NTFS or whatever we use onto the SSD and hope that it behaves like an amazing hard disk, a piece of magic. Right, so if we're gonna solve these big data type problems in the way I framed it before, we need to understand how to exploit these guys. Actually, just as a side thing, so this is what happens if you take an SSD, say one of the more well known SSDs, and you pick random 512 kilobyte offsets and you write a random 512k buffer into those offsets, and you do that for a long time. you can't see my pointer, but if you look at where the insertion rate drops off, this is pretty much the capacity of the device. Right, so the number of kilobytes is on the bottom, so you get to like 160 or 170 gigs, and the capacity, the write throughput just falls off a cliff. What on earth's going on here? They don't tell you that in the manual, right? But if you want to have any sort of big data platform where you're ingesting lots of stuff, you need to understand this, and you need to have ways of dealing with it, or ideally to stop it happening in the first place. So the second thing is about workloads. Workloads are the other thing that are changing massively, right? Like Mark said, you've got huge scale and huge problems of hotspots and all sorts of things like that when people start liking Lady Gaga's latest album. So, you know, the kind of workloads that I think are really telling have the following characteristics, at least, right? They have huge numbers of tiny, tiny small entries, right? You know, like people tracking cookies that people have, every time someone clicks on an ad or on a website, stock ticks, that sort of stuff. The other distinguishing feature is that the entries themselves don't really have any value, right? If I lose 1% of all the times, you know, of all the records of people clicking on my favorite website, I don't really care. I care if I'm a bank and I'm caring about doing transactions, you know, if I've transferred $10 from account X to account Y and I lose it, that's kind of stupid. But for this, I don't really care. So the entries have really little value, and if you're happy to give up some durability and things like that, you can gain a lot. So we have to understand what trade-offs we can make there. The third point about workloads is that, you know, they're often very high entropy, high rate ingests, sort of orders of, you know, we want to do millions of updates a second of these tiny, worthless entries, but yet we also want to do very large range queries over them for you know, analytics and the sort of Hadoop world. So the question I have here is, are existing abstractions and algorithms, again, right? One thing's for sure is that, you know, putting a B-tree on a hard drive is not going to be able to get us that sort of performance. We've got to look beyond that, and just putting them onto an SSD is probably not the right answer either. The third point is about scale. So, you know, I'm sure we're all aware that scale is completely unavoidable now, right? Consider, you know, everyone here has a social media startup worth $900 million, right? Imagine that you want to achieve, you know, sort of 5, 6, 7 nines reliability. I mean, are you really going to go and pay EMC millions of dollars to get a huge whacking box and then reinforce your floor to deal with it? You're not, right? You're just going to go and buy some more pizza boxes and scale out just because you've heard it's possible and, you know, there are things out there which purport to be able to do that. So, you know, it's going to happen now. We're not going to be able to stop people doing it. But the challenge is in getting to grips with all the problems that scaling out brings. So, you know, the cap theorem, vector clocks, and all that sort of stuff. And here, I think, is where looking back into the literature is really important, not pretending that we need to reinvent the wheel for every single thing we do, which I have to say is a trait in the NoSQL community to some degree. And I want to finish on this slide. So maybe it's not about surfing, but it's about baking. I quite like this quote, so I just copied it verbatim, pretty much. But I'll read it just for the sake of it. So the guy's saying, look, there's more to this big data, right? Perhaps it's too early to expect a renaissance. It's like we're medieval artists who are struggling to move beyond the concept of flat images. We're too consumed in the technological marvels of what we've created to really understand the implications of what we've discovered and what we can create with it. It's the software that mixes and cooks up the data which will truly transform the world. And when that data is as accessible as flour is for baking or clay for sculpting, only then will Hadoop and other technologies like that have real meaning. So I guess what I want to say is there are lots of problems in the technical sense at the lower levels, but there are lots of huge problems about how we actually think in a different way about what we can do with these sort of huge amounts of big data that we can actually store and crunch now. And I have no idea what will happen with that. And sorry for the cock-up earlier. It's Steve Jobs' fault.
Never apologize. It was planned to warm the crowd up.
It was
just to give you a chance to think and comment, and now hopefully this will just work. Ha, ha, ha. Ten, nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three. Oh, you're good. You're good to go.
All right. Is this thing on?
Yep.
Cool. Hi, I'm Andy Gross from Basho Technologies. We make one of these NoSQL things called Reoc. You might have heard of it. It's a Dynamo-inspired, sort of horizontally scalable NoSQL store. And my, you know, controversial statement here is that big data in and of itself, the idea of big data, is relatively boring. The interesting part is that most big data problems are actually, at their core, distributed systems problems. Because, you know, if you can fit all the data on one machine, it's not really big, is it? And at the heart of these problems is the architecture and design of distributed systems to actually get this data, you know, onto disk and to retrieve it in a usable fashion. So when I was preparing for this talk, I was sort of thinking about what's happened in the last 6 or 7 years, and it's really kind of amazing. You know, if you went back to 2005 to your average, you know, Python users group meetup or sitting in a coffee shop or bar in San Francisco, and you just listened to what developers were talking about, it was blog APIs and, you know, do we use RSS or Atom, and fighting about Ruby on Rails versus something else. All kind of boring stuff. And, you know, fast forward to today, and, you know, just be a fly on the wall at one of these meetups, and you hear people talking about Paxos and CAP, the CAP theorem, and talking about consistent hashing and vector clocks, and how to do client-side conflict resolution with vector clocks. So it's really changed a lot. You know, this stuff used to be the territory of, you know, academia or big companies like Akamai and Google. You know, it was, you know, at Akamai, I think I first heard about Paxos, and before that, you know, I think it was at least 10 years from the publication of the original Paxos paper till anyone even started to try to implement it in industry. But now these things are regularly used tools in your standard sort of in the trenches developers stack, which is very interesting and also very scary in a lot of ways. So, you know, I think we're in sort of a renaissance of distributed systems. This is just a random sampling. Some of them are more true distributed systems than others. But these are all things that have popped up within the last 5, maybe 6 years, and are now part of most new application stacks. So where you used to have, you know, a single relational database at the bottom of your stack, you know, the diagram that you're all familiar with, now you have much more complicated architectures that are made up of individual services, some of which each have their own data storage, maybe coordinated by something like ZooKeeper. So why is this happening? One of them is the cloud. Try going to a venture capitalist nowadays and tell them that you're going to buy your own hardware, and you'll get laughed out of the room. They're going to say, no, you're going to do it on EC2 or you're not getting any money. So that's one of the reasons. The notion of horizontally scalable architectures on commodity hardware, which was, you know, first only something that, again, companies like Akamai and Google did, is now something that everybody has to do or at least think about. And workloads, again, are changing, mainly due to the types of applications. You know, the web isn't just a read-only thing anymore. Every sort of object on the web now, in most cases, can be written back to, and you see this in social and mobile. And people expect more from the web than they used to. You know, if you're a hot startup and you go down for 5 minutes, you're on the front page of TechCrunch saying, you know, you guys are over. So high availability is much more a business requirement now than it ever was before. And another thing that I think is a large part of big data is, or a large fraction of the big data that's out there, is previously untapped data that people used to just sort of drop on the floor that now actually has real business value, whether that's analytics about how people use your site or simply stuff that you didn't have the capacity or didn't think of storing before. When I was at Akamai, there was data that we dropped on the floor for years and years and years, BGP logs, statistics about TCP performance in various data centers that, you know, 4 or 5 years later, we started capturing, and we got a lot of revenue out of that. So I think a lot of this big data isn't, a lot of this big data is there now, but we're just not capturing it. And now that we have a means to and the technology to, that's a big reason why these horizontally scalable databases have become popular. So at the very least, we're going to need a new set of Visio stencils to describe this stuff. This you know, relational database icon that used to neatly encapsulate all the consistency concerns in an application. You know, 10 years ago, a developer would push a WAR file out to a WebSphere server, and that was the scope of a developer's influence on an application. Now, you have developers pushing entire machine images out to Amazon with consistency, with, you know, data layers that are much more complicated. We can't just delegate all the concerns about consistency to this nice relational database because we've reached, in some cases, we've reached the limit of scale for these things. But I think we're making progress towards towards being able to think about this stuff in a useful way. And, you know, we're sort of developing a language and maybe, you know, sort of patterns, if you will, for talking about and implementing this stuff. The first thing that comes to mind was the paper that really blew my mind was the Bloom paper by Alvaro and Hellerstein. I think it was Hellerstein, Neil Conway from Berkeley. Bloom, which some of you have probably heard of, it's a Ruby DSL that can do consistency analysis and encourages sort of order-independent programming and can tell you the parts of your program that are fine with sort of eventual consistency and the points in your program that need some consistent coordination. And any paper that comes with an implementation of Paxos in just a few lines of code is good in my book. So more stuff like this would be great. Papers that begin with, you know, assume a network in which processes never fail, while they may be valuable in a purely theoretical sense, as far as people building stuff in industry, they're pretty much useless. Experimentation, being able to prototype and play with distributed systems ideas without having to start from the ground up is also important. And this is a little plug for something I'm working on at Basho, React Core, which is all the distributed systems complexity that is in React sort of separated out into its own generic toolkit. So you can, you know, start with this and not have to re-implement things like failure detection and vector clocks and consistent hashing for spreading load. It's a Dynamo-style framework. But it's growing to be more than that. One of the problems, and, you know, when I talk to customers, usually maybe 80% of what they need to do works with an eventually consistent model, but there's always, you know, 10 or 20% that really needs that strong consistency. So, you know, eventual consistency isn't going to get us all the way there. So we've begun experimenting with supporting sort of being able to opt into stronger consistency models. One of our employees has implemented the Zookeeper atomic broadcast protocol on top of React Core. So in the future, you know, you might be able to say, you know, for these classes of objects, the eventually consistent client-side conflict resolution model is fine, but for this one little piece of data, I want that to be coordinated in a sort of Paxos two-phase commit, whatever style. And more in the realm of storage, we're finally seeing permissively licensed modern storage engines. Stasis, which I think Mark had something to do with, and LevelDB, which just came out from Google, are modern storage engines that people can use to write their own products. An interesting thing about what we do at Basho is, I'd say maybe only 5% of the work that we do is on the act of putting bits onto disk. Most of it is the distributed systems problem around it. So the more stuff that comes out like this lets us focus on the hard parts and delegate the actual disk storage to well-tested tools like LevelDB, which was just a sort of gift from the heavens that Google gave us. So some questions and open problems. The regular sort of enterprise testing and the enterprise software lifecycle isn't really suited for deploying distributed systems at these large scales. The bug that happens, a very small bug can be a killer. Global replication. We get a lot of customers calling us that say we want multi-master replication with 7 data centers. That's not easy, or maybe it's not even possible. But we need to figure out. We need practical research in how to do that better. And back to the cloud, the relatively poor I/O performance that you see on the cloud introduces, what does that change about the underlying system model that we think about when we talk about databases? And finally, operating these systems as they become more complex becomes very hard. Some of the most complicated stuff that we did at Akamai was, how do we install this network when all these components have complicated dependencies among each other? So research into how to do that efficiently, I think, is something that we need to see more of. And that's it for me. Thank you.
I'll try to respect Irfan's keep it moving clock. So in about 7 years at Google, I've learned a lot about what apps really need from the storage stack. I think we need to move past this false dichotomy between sort of little complicated databases and huge scalable but maybe oversimplified ones. The thing is, apps didn't stop being complicated when their data got too big for a single MySQL. Big data eventually means you have a big system, and that complexity is going to get implemented at some layer in the stack. So the question for storage and database people, and you're right, just distributed systems people, is how do you push that complexity back down? So here's the kind of life cycle this stuff goes through. You start with a good idea, you have an app, you put its data somewhere. Pretty soon it looks like this. You have kind of a bunch of semi-independent services all using each other's data in pretty complicated ways. They all have to solve the same set of cross-cutting concerns. And they interact with that data in much more complicated ways than is supported by current NoSQL stores. So any locally maximizing team which wants to ship does the obvious thing. They build all the missing stuff in their application layer. And obviously, they don't do as good a job of it as if you would be done if you could figure out the common things and push it back down. So how do I think we should solve these problems? A lot of features from the SQL world got thrown away, I think, just because they're hard to implement and scale, not because apps don't need them. So I think it's time to bite the bullet and just figure out how to scale some of this stuff. There are also areas that really were never gotten right in SQL apps. And which only get worse as you scale in both size and in the number of people working on this data. And I'll hint at a few of them here. So how do you keep an app team moving quickly? I think transactions have a really central place in letting people write features instead of infrastructure. You've got some persistent data structure that's corrupt. Life's a lot easier if you know you've got a bug and not a concurrency anomaly. Margaret was talking at breakfast about how if something happens one in a million times, that means it happens a lot of times a day at Google. And you know, I think stuff like TPCC benchmark is totally irrelevant here. Nobody ever gets conflicts because there aren't any conflicts except for every 5 seconds or something. So unless your database is so slow that your transactions take 5 seconds, these ways that people usually study the workloads are, you know, pretty useless. And, you know, users do not tolerate the sort of flakiness that comes of these consistency anomalies when you move really complicated, formerly rock-solid desktop apps to the cloud. We've also seen a long tail of low-frequency, high-complexity operations like merging user accounts that really is better done with distributed transactions. And there's some fun computer science in letting those distributed transactions be slow without slowing everything down around them. You want users to express their queries concisely, not in huge loops of, you know, PHP code or something, pulling all that data together. And we've had really good luck sort of treifying SQL. Don't have time to say much more about that. Joins are a big deal. So you really want the UI developer to be unblocked to get at whatever data he wants to get at to render an interesting page. And you can't sort of just say, you know, the backend guys decide what's been denormalized in advance, and that's all the UI people can render. They present obvious scaling problems when you're running on a data center sized database, and, you know, the fun computer science comes back. How do we build good data structures that can be served up through RDMA network cards without CPU intervention? How does the database decide which joins, you know, which partial joins to keep as standing queries or materialized views? And semi-public ACLD search is a really interesting problem there, that second bullet at the top. And then how do you not beat your buffers to a pulp is a pretty tough problem. You do not have time to wait for TCP retries. Sync, I think, the user-defined conflict resolution function is another one of these myths in the literature that's basically unimplementable and means you've punted all the hard stuff. Google Wave may have met an untimely end, but they really understood how to do sync. It starts down in the data model and the set of operations that are available. I think people rarely get this right trying to hack it on top as an afterthought. Predictable performance. I thought you were going to talk a little more in your surfing slides about how to avoid accumulating this enormous debt. You know, these write-optimized stores, they're just punting all of the compaction work downstream, and Google's, you know, Bigtable certainly guilty of this. Figuring out how to pay as you go so that all of that work never builds up sort of surprising latency spikes later. And isolation is ridiculously hard, especially of spindles. The elevator algorithm in the firmware, plus the kernel fighting with you, plus whatever scheduling you're trying to do in your, you know, storage node in user land. They all compete with each other, and nobody wins. This last point is the most nebulous, I think, if predictable performance is the hardest. You've got a bunch of separate teams that are all working on their own little islands of data. And if you're going to have the users get all of their data in interesting ways, sort of combined from across all of the separate small teams that own that data, they need to be able to come together in one tightly integrated system. And part of this is the schema change problem. How do you sort of virtualize your data so that your internal schema changes are isolated from other parts of your company or the other consumers of your data? Yet all of this data is surfaced in standardized ways that you can sync and join across so that you don't just have n squared pairwise interfaces between every team that wants to, you know, borrow each other's data. The ultimate goal here is, you know, if you're going to move as fast as a team that's just its own little four-person startup but have data that's integrated, you know, in a 1,000-person company with all of those other little micro startups, you've got to sort of localize the risk and normalize, standardize the communication between these teams. Snarky slide. Thanks. Questions?
Okay, so we've heard multiple different perspectives on big data, what's hard, what's not, what we should be doing. Please race up to the mic to get your questions asked. And while you're doing that, I'll start with my favorite question. But seriously, get to the mic. When you get to the mic, introduce yourself so that you're not anonymous, and let's push these guys to figure out what's really going on here. So here's my pet question. Every one of you guys talked about scaling out with the implication that the only way we get scale is by throwing more machines at it. Now, it turns out that machines come with power supplies, and power supplies draw energy, and energy requires air to cool. And so I, in my new career as a data center operator, am worried about the cost associated with scaling out. And I haven't heard any of you actually talk about scaling up, and that is leveraging what I have on a single machine, which is now on the order of 4, 8, 16, and, you know, next week, 64 cores. So do you guys just think that's not interesting? You don't care? You like buying power supplies? What do you think about the scale up versus scale out question?
You're just scaling out across cores.
Exactly. And should, okay, so should I use the exact same technique scaling across cores that I use across different machines?
So even if you're on a NUMA machine, it's not just about lock contention. You have to think about this as a bunch of separate machines if you're going to do an efficient job of sharing, you know, 64 cores with 64 gigs of RAM. It's not one monolithic machine. And so, you know, certainly it's a smaller scale, but yes, it's a loud
problem. I think it's
the
same problem. Anybody else want to chime in?
I tend to think it's the same problem as well, except that...
So I'm going to run Paxos across my multi-core?
Well, maybe not that. Maybe not to that degree. But I think that that's at odds with trying to scale up and scale less horizontally and utilize machines more, individual machines more, is at odds with fault tolerance and availability goals, because I don't think the bigger machines tend to fail less. So I think there's a fundamental tension between, buying large, a lesser amount of large machines and many.
Though if you have fewer of them.
Well, but my point is that you can't buy a small machine anymore. The first thing you buy has four thread context.
Pretty big. No, you're right. But
I mean, my point would be that look at how many disks and cores and RAM you can put into a single machine, and tell me how many databases right now can't you fit onto a machine with 32 3 terabyte disks. So capacity is probably not an issue unless you're, you know, one of the huge guys. But I guess some of the stuff I was alluding to earlier was, you know, look at SSDs, for example. You can get a huge amount of IOPS from them. You can get a huge number of CPU operations a second from 16 cores or 32 cores. I think one of the problems is that existing technologies or existing algorithms, for example, don't allow you to get that sort of the performance that is available. And so you have to scale. Then you say, oh, I have to scale out now. But you know, there's another option.
Do you want to add anything, Mark?
Just in the MySQL community, there's a performance consulting company that's really good. And one of their frequent topics is a few too many customers are focused on scaling out when scaling up would be sufficient.
Exactly. I mean,
for many of us, we're going to run on multiple machines regardless of how big one machine is. But now that you can get in a commodity machine, more IOPS than you can possibly use, and half a terabyte of RAM, that a lot of customers can run on that today, and eventually they should worry about scaling out, but not now.
Okay. All right, good. We have people at the mic. Take it away, Bradley.
So I'm Bradley Kuzma from MIT and Toku Tech. I would have to disagree with the statement that for these kinds of applications that a new machine NUMA machine is like a scale-out machine. It's not. For these applications, I/O is the dominant cost of performance, and so the question is, how many disk drives can you get on a machine? And yeah, you can get 32 disk drives onto a machine, and for some people that's enough, but for something like Facebook, you know, you still need a lot of drives. And in fact, by the time you we put together the kind of machine that Mark must be using, which must cost, you know, $5,000 or $10,000, I have a hard time believing that the power cost is actually a significant part of the cost of that machine. Is it?
Well, we've begun running what you could say a cluster on a box, multiple instances of MySQL, because the previous generation of machines, which we can't just get rid of, have a certain size database. And the new hardware has no problem supporting that. It has a lot of spare capacity. So if we use yesterday's database as the distribution unit, well, now the newer hardware can support multiple units. So just for the reason that we have this old hardware. That's why we're now carving up.
Because you want all the units to be the same size.
Yes, a bin packing problem.
It's also nice for the latency tail. You sort of get to share CPU spikes among, if you have bigger pools of CPU accessible to each process, even if you're running a couple different processes on the same big machine, if they can steal each other's CPU sometimes, that's a much nicer scenario than having them each locked onto a separate machine.
I think I'd be happy if I were CPU, you know, if on these, you know, I have a 48 core machine. It's like, it's not next week, it's last year I bought this 48 core AMD machine. If I could get all of those cores running.
If you want to be CPU bound, put HBase on there.
or run lots of compression.
Right.
So I have a quick, I have a question from Andy, for Andy Twigg. You did this experiment with random writes on the SSD, and it fell off. Is that because the SSD was organized as one big partition, and eventually the system ran out of capacity to reorganize?
No, it's a physical limitation of the SSD and not understanding how it actually works internally. So it exposes an interface because it wants to pretend it's a block device, right, or a hard drive, and so it's sector addressable and so on. But this is to do with the remapping and all the stuff like that and the block erasers and things like that which are going on. Eventually it reaches a point where every time you try and write a 512K buffer, you're doing something like 9 or 10 512K block erasers.
So I have not tried this myself, but I saw an Intel white paper where they said, partition your drive so you only fill it up 85% full, so that you have plenty of spare capacity for that garbage collection to happen. Does that help, or is that just...
So you can try partitioning it 50%, and it doesn't make... I mean, it makes some difference, but...
Yeah. So if you stop pushing on it and go away for an hour and come back, can you drive it hard again?
Usually, yes. I haven't run too many experiments, but there are cases where you can get it into a corner and it's garbage collection, can't get out.
There's a paper on this from Sitter this year, this spring. If you're curious, with lots of graphs of different drives and how hard you push them when, what happens.
Yeah. So it's worth noting that was what they call an MLC drive, which is like the consumer grade ones, but you can get the enterprise grade ones, which you can't, it's possible to avoid that drop off. And one of the ways they achieve that is by massively, massively over provisioning it. So they sell you a 32 gig drive, but you know it's actually got 64 gigs or so on.
Yeah. So I still have problems because I don't see a performance.
Let's go on to another question. Eric.
Hi, Eric Riddell from EMC. I have a question for Alex. When you drew up your stack of the applications and the infrastructure, you said that the complexity has to be somewhere, mm-hmm. and you're talking about moving it around the stack. Is that really true? Totally? There's no way to choke off the complexity at the source, and then if not, then how did you decide where to push it? Where is complexity better housed?
So. Certainly you don't want everything in the database, you know, you don't want the spell checker in the database. So I agree that this argument sort of ad absurdum becomes absurd. There are a lot of things that look like database-y problems that are getting pushed into the application. You know, sort of if I am, you know, Blogger and I need access to your contacts and maybe some of your documents from, you know, the more you want to integrate these applications, you start pulling data together from a bunch of different tables into one query with little bits of data from many different tables, and that's what joins are. And the sort of, if I have an offline app that wants some 10% of my data accessible and I want to run queries on that data, and I want those query results to update incrementally when I get back online and, you know, I've done a search in my offline Gmail and then those messages blip in as my 3G gets signal again, those are clearly common storage-y problems that are the same whether I'm syncing email messages or Facebook comments or anything else. And it does not make sense to implement those in a sort of ad hoc way once per application.
So the philosophy is to look for repeated instances of the same complexity and do that in the infrastructure.
Yeah, I was claiming that many of those things, and even some things that don't sound like databasey problems, but standardizing like legal discovery, how do you let the Google lawyers respond to a subpoena without every single app implementing the same Google lawyer respond to the subpoena site? A lot of those things are so similar across applications that it's silly to put a sort of development tax having everyone have to re-implement them.
I'd like to add one thing to what Alex says. Running MySQL at Google and then at Facebook, replication lag, because we use asynchronous replication. Replication lag is a hard problem to get developers to understand and to build tools about, hey, when can I use the slave versus the master? And it's just too difficult a problem. And so with what they did with Megastore with synchronous replication just ends the discussion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I mean, the NoSQL systems, the eventually consistent ones, React included, you know, threw out a lot of good stuff from relational databases, and you're seeing people wanting to use these systems and implementing very complex client-side resolution code for conflicts that, you know, I think it's a temporary problem that we need to solve. You know, a lot of this stuff does not belong in the application at all.
Jeff Canning, Harvey Mudd College. I'm going to annoy Margo by returning to SSDs. I remember a time when IBM tried to make tape drives look like punch cards. And I remember a time when we ran tape algorithms on disks. Isn't it about time we started writing file systems that are actually written for SSDs instead of trying to pretend that they're disk drives?
I guess that's what I was alluding to, yeah.
Does this even belong at the file system layer, or should we just, you know, in the same way SQL Server doesn't deal with the file system when it's messing with disks, should we stop pretending that they're block devices at all and let the database say, okay, here you've got four I/O channels, you know, keep track of what blocks you're going to erase, what blocks you've written, and build a whole new sort of copy-on-write data structure that's taking advantage of this sort of kind of like an append file system, but with four of them thing that is really in the hardware. Is that worth doing?
Maybe, but there's another problem, which is that if you look at the storage stack, there's so many assumptions in there which are implicit about how hard drives work.
Oh, sure. This doesn't work for B-trees.
Well, for hard drives in general, for rotational drives, not B-trees.
The layers above, maybe I'm not understanding your question.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree in general, yeah.
So let me be a jerky moderator and interject here. So if you look at what happened to the main, sort of the big database guys, right, the MySQL, the Oracle, or the SQL Server, Oracle DB2, historically they did run on raw partitions. And then, you know, in sort of the 90s, we saw them move away from running on raw partitions, and many of them do now run on top of the file system. And what you're saying is, well, let's actually move back and not run on top of the file system. So
even when
that may
be
true, but the question is, you know, there are benefits you get to the file system, and so how do you make that trade-off?
You're in the industry more than I am. When you're on the file system, you're just sort of pre-allocating a big file and then using it like a partition within a volume, right?
Some do, some don't, yeah.
It seems like the ways that they were going around the file system were, the file system is less in your way on a disk that really is just giving you, you know, random IOPS on a block device than it seems to me in SSDs with this enormously complicated thing going on in the background so that it can pretend to be a block device.
Right. And maybe it's the FTLs that we're actually complaining about, right? These flash translation layers that sit above the SSDs.
So one of the upcoming sort of major advances in SSDs over the next 5 years is going to be that you, say you want to do a B-tree walk, right? You don't want to have, you know, the time to go to the SSD and back again is actually pretty big. So you want to offload all the logic for doing your B-tree walks, let's say, if you're doing a B-tree, onto the SSD.
Wow, we're reinventing IBM disk drives in the 70s.
Yeah, it's all coming around, right?
Cool. So those of us with gray hair will be all employed again. Good. Peter.
Peter
Maybe
does
it can emulate a tape drive or something as well.
Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern. Bringing it back a little bit to the topic of big data instead of small SSDs. I hear different reasons for scaling out here, where, you know, there's memory,
there's how many disks, there's basically disk, whether spindle or raw capacity, there's CPU. You know, if the four of you were to fight it out over what, why you really find applications needing to scale out instead of scale up, what would you say is the reason?
I would say failure tolerance.
Fault tolerance and the prevalence of the, or, you know, people are being forced onto the cloud. You really don't have much of a choice nowadays, especially if you're starting a new company.
Well, you can only scale so far up, I think, is the dominant reason, at least once you're at Google scale.
But most people, the databases are only a certain size as well, so.
Okay, thank you.
How are we on time? Are we done, or do we have? Okay, who wants? Who has the doozy of a question? Come on, now's your chance to be famous and wrap us up on a high note.
And not at the speed.
All right, thank you.
Actually, it's a kind of a dumb question. I'm Albert Chen from Western Digital. So the question I have is, as you get more hard drives to scale your database, there's the capacity worries, and there's also the energy cost of spinning the hard drive. So for a data center, do you want to see it being more, which one would you put more priority in, the energy use or more the capacity growth? Because eventually, for example, in terms of going later, we could have more of a hybrid hard drives with flash building as part of the, along with Palladium. So you could have some energy saving there, but how about in terms of capacity? So which one would you put more emphasis on?
So I think the question is translating into, are you willing to pay capacity to get better power performance?
I'm dubious that we would get predictable performance from a hybrid flash and rotating drive. I think this would create another one of these complicated systems that's very hard to understand once you've beaten it up for an hour. You know, the flash write back is full and some needle falls off a cliff. There are a lot of people working on this sort of, you know, tiered storage, but it seems unclear to me that I would want to trust that to the drive firmware.
So I think that the people who care about power at companies are still not close enough to the people running and implementing the database servers?
Yeah, I'll admit to not even considering it when I think about stuff, and maybe that needs to change. But it's just a given that there's going to be power there, in at least my thinking, and I think a lot of other people's.
Certainly it's true that most space is stranded behind spindles for us, and to the extent that for a given megawatt you can get more IOPS, we want that, I think.
Hi, my name is Rick Spillane. I'm from Steinberg University. And I have sort of a question that I'm personally interested in about this, these sort of big data problems. And one thing that I keep bumping into in my research is that doing writes fast and scaling out, I won't use the word easy, but you can see that there are paths that people have already blazed and you can see, you know, how to go. One question, though, that I'm sort of interested in, if any of the panelists have experience on this, is oftentimes you want to resolve consistency conflicts after the fact, after the user has walked away from the keyboard. Could be like a day later or 2 days later. One way of dealing with it is just not resolve them at all. Another way is to have some kind of application that resolves them, or another way is to just, you know, make the user wait to send messages across the link to actually get locks and things like that. I'm sort of curious, from an industry perspective, how this is normally dealt with. Does this question make sense?
Yeah, I think I can speak for what React does and what I see our customers do. I'd say 70%, React will save all potential conflicting objects, and you can either have it choose the latest one by just wall clock, physical timestamp, or ask for them all. And I think some data structures are very amenable to resolution on the client side. The Amazon shopping cart is sort of the canonical example of that. And some of them aren't. And then people tend to just choose last right wins. And I think, you know, as apps mature, some of those ones where you choose the last right wins policy can be refactored into data structures that do become more amenable to the client side resolution or automatic server side resolution via some policy.
Thank you.
It degenerates to being as hard as, you know, multi-core programming without mutexes, where you're trying to make a linked list with a bunch of compare and swaps or something, except you don't even always have compare and swap until 2 days later.
Right.
So for apps that can tolerate the latency, which does mean you can't do, you know, 100 writes in a row in a for loop while the user's waiting, the answer at Google for a large class of applications has been just use Paxos and ACID transactions and make the user wait.
Okay.
All right, let's thank our panelists.